And this is what we also gather from the Holy Quran, like the verses such as this. In another verse we read, man prays for evil as avidly as he prays for good, and man is overhasty. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, that good whose end consequence is the fire is not good, and that hardship whose end consequence is paradise is not bad. Every bliss other than paradise is inferior, and every calamity other than the fire itself is a comfort. Right? So, you know, if something we think is good, we end up going to hell for it. Well, that thing is not good. And also, if something we think is bad, but we end up going to heaven for it, well, it's not bad. It's something good. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the measure of good and evil in the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Bahrain has made history, but for the wrong reasons. Bahrain's King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa met President Isaac Herzog in the first visit by an Israeli president to the Persian Gulf island. From there, Herzog went to the UAE. The Abraham Accords has made these visits possible, U.S. brokered agreements that ushered in the so-called normalization between Israel and several Persian Gulf Arab states, including the UAE and Bahrain. Now, as much as Israel would like to show that its relations with Persian Gulf Arab countries is flourishing, well, the citizens of those countries and the wider Arab world are vehemently against that and have vowed to never recognize Israel. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator, joins us from Beirut. Also joining us is Syed Nimr, who's a professor of political science, joining us from Bursait University from occupied Ramallah.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Laith Maarouf, I'll first start with you over there in Beirut. So you have this visit by Isaac Herzog visiting for the first time at the invitation of the King of Bahrain to that Persian Gulf island. Now, according to what we have resourced to meet members of the local Jewish community and some senior government officials, and along with him, he's taken a business delegation to meet Bahraini business people. But that doesn't sound like something that other Israeli officials couldn't do. Why do you think then it was him and the purpose of his trip going to the Persian Gulf island of Bahrain? It seems like it would be more than that.
Well, of course, this is happening at the same time as the World Cup in Qatar is happening. And we see Herzog is not visiting Qatar. He's visiting Bahrain and the Emirates on both sides of Qatar after the public humiliation that the Israeli media received from the fans, local Saudi, Qatari, Emirati, Bahraini fans that rejected any interviews with the Zionist media and stood up for Palestine. We also have to remember for the last 3 days before the visit of Herzog landing in Bahrain, the Bahraini population was out on demonstrations on a daily basis, showing that they reject this normalization and collaboration with the enemy of the Palestinian Arab and Muslim people, the Zionist colony. And in fact, Herzog had to change all his local events and agenda inside Bahrain in order to hide himself from the population, and had to cut down his meeting in Bahrain to the bare minimums. When they say he's meeting with local Jewish community, what they mean is foreign Western Jewish people that are in Bahrain. There is no Jewish Bahrainis. And there's definitely no Jewish Emiratis.
Indeed. Well, Sadner, maybe we need to really dive into how bad this, I guess, feelings that came out during the World Cup against Israel, and how people, I mean, it wasn't just like people saying, oh, are you an Israeli media? I don't want to talk to you. It wasn't like that. People were angry when they found out that it was an Israeli reporter that wanted to talk to them. Can you explain to us the hatred that was displayed there in many instances when this happened?
In reality, we have to differentiate quite obviously between the rulers in the Arab world and between the people. The people never ever lost their compass towards Palestine, towards Jerusalem, towards the issue of the Palestinian people, and against Israel as a colonial project in the Arab world. So the feeling is a genuine one. It's a real one among the Arab people in general, and that explains the lot of humiliation that the Israeli reporters had just came. And in one of those incidents, it was from Moroccan people who just, you know, refused to make an interview. And the reporter said, but we have peace process between us and your country. But, you know, it's like, you know, they were trying to fit somehow, but definitely the Arab world was against. And this is quite normal, because as I said from the very beginning, there is a different between the rulers and the people themselves in the Arab world. Now, for Yitzhak Herzog's visit, we have to understand something. In the Israeli regime, the president have no fact or real power in politics. It's just a public relation. And I believe that part of this visit, it's a kind of public relation, and try to fix a little bit the image, because all the articles and the media in Israel in the last week was focusing on how Abraham treaty or peace process that they were announcing with the Gulf states particularly is a total failure. And it's, you know, a treaty only with the rulers and not with the people. And the people, in reality, they hate them. Because of that, it's a kind of a public relation kind of visit. It won't take any more, you know, even any kind of political power or importance.
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm curious, Leith Maruf. It's supposed to be a public relation move there by Israel. Leith Maruf, are you with us? Okay, great. I thought we lost you there for a second. If it's supposed to be a public relations move, so how would the Israeli president display the success of Abraham Accords? I mean, what can he say? Because there's obvious detachments when it comes to Palestinians and what they're doing to them, and of course then amongst themselves, the Israeli presidents or officials with the Persian Gulf Arab countries. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, clearly he's dragging with him all the Israeli media to go to Bahrain, and specifically to counter the media image that appeared from the ground in Doha, in Qatar, during the World Cup. And I'm going to take this chance right now to say congratulations to all the African, Arab, and Muslim people for Morocco beating their former colonizer, Spain, just in a beautiful game. And Morocco, of course, was the last African, last Arab, last Muslim team on the ground. And Morocco, as being a country that supposedly signed normalization, its team was carrying the Palestinian flag on the ground, on the pitch, just now after they beat Spain. Their crowds were carrying the Palestinian flag everywhere, and Palestine was the biggest winner with the win of Morocco and this World.
Okay. Looks like this time we may have lost Mr. Laith Maarouf. All right. So maybe it's a good time, Saad Nimr, to ask you if you can please explain to us what this so-called Abraham Accords was, what its goal was, and how it's doing.
Well, you know, the Israeli and behind them also the Americans who pressurized the Arab countries to go ahead with these kind of treaties in order to bring it out as a kind of a success to Israel and to the peace and to all this kind of media issues. During Netanyahu's period, it was a kind of giving Israel some glamorous image around in the world, that they, in spite of what's going with the Palestinians or against the Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza and in Al-Quds, Jerusalem, but Israel is really keen for the peace, and they are willing for the peace. So they came out with this idea of the Abraham Accord, establishing that there is no differences between Muslims, Christians, and Jews, because we are all descendants from Abraham. And the Israeli do concentrate a lot on Abraham, and even some of the settlements in Hebron called Abraham Abino, our father is Abraham. So they focus on this issue and saying that all religions came out from descendants of Abraham, which is basically, from their point of view, the father of the Jewish religion. However, regardless of all that, it's just a name to make sure that we are living in peace between all religions, and it's religions is not in contract with each other, or in contact with each other, or in a conflict, let me say, with each other, and it's time to make peace, especially in the Gulf states. However, the Israelis all the time, their eyes were on the Gulf. They always there, especially on Saudi Arabia,
sure,
and other bigger countries, even in the Gulf, not in Bahrain and Emirates, though Emirates is very important economically. But they were always looking to that. And I think even in 2002, the Saudi initiative for normalization in return for the land which is occupied by the Israelis in 1967, including Golan Heights, was the issue here for the Israelis. They always talked about normalization first, and after that we will think of other issues, such as pulling out from the occupied territories.
Well, the Abraham Accords, Laith Maarouf, in a matter of speaking, it was something that was introduced, and correct me if I'm wrong, it was accompanied by this Bahraini economic incentive or initiative, which the former president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was a key architect of, which that didn't really spice things up enough, because it was evading the reality of the matter. But moving down this Abraham Accords, I'd like to get your thoughts on the fact that this plan, I mean, we need to touch on this, based on one of the lead negotiators, which was a general from Puerto Rico, who had said the plan was that if we get, I'm quoting him, the plan was that if we get everybody around the Palestinians to recognize Israel, then where does that leave the Palestinians? They'll have to come because they're on an island. So that from the get-go showed the real goal behind that, which is not something that's really highlighted.
Oh, yes, definitely. The whole goal was to isolate the Palestinians, say, similarly as happened in 1992 with the Madrid Agreement. The Jordanians broke off and forced the Palestinians to be standing alone, and they made the mistake not to stand with Syria at the time in rejecting the Oslo Accords. Now, what we saw really right now is that Israel is the one isolated, is the one that is an island in a body of humanity that rejects its supremacy. And this, although the Emiratis and Bahrainis were supposed to throw their money on the Palestinians to lift them up, supposedly, so they don't fight back, they didn't do that. They didn't throw their money on the Palestinians. They threw their money at the Israelis. Without the trade that the Emiratis are doing right now with Israel, the Zionists will be in a real big problem. Just now, the numbers yesterday came out. Almost a quarter of the GDP of Israel has been purchases by the Emirates, specifically of the blood diamonds stolen from Africa and cut in Israel by Israeli jewelers are now being sold in the Emirates for crazy amounts of money. So no, the Bahrainis and the Emiratis are not doing anything to help the Palestinians. They're doing things to help themselves because they think as dictators of Bahrain and the Emirates, they think that they can only survive if they hitch their ride on the Zionist colonizers. And believe me, I think they're going to be trying to hitch a ride on the planes leaving, like in Afghanistan, when the liberation of Palestine happens very soon, inshallah.
So since we're talking about Saad Nimr, UAE and Bahrain, one of the reasons that Bahrain is said to be interested in wanting to go ahead with the so-called normalization with Israel was because it was trying to pretty much escape the human rights violations that it has exercised minimum from the year 2011 onwards, which we know includes torture, detainments, etc. I'm sure you're well aware of that. But in particular, the UAE, I mean, what was the reason for them to also want to join in the two of the Persian Gulf Arab countries to, at this point, have done that?
Well, yeah, okay. There is many aspects here. First of all, we have to differentiate between Bahrain and Emirates in their situations, and we'll explain that. The second thing is that the American pressure, and especially during Trump administration and his son-in-law, Kushner, and they make a big pressure in favor of for Israel, as a favor for Israel. And also we have to understand also the nature of what was going on and the nature of what kind of agreements between Bahrain on one hand and on EU with Israel on the other hand. Now, the first thing is that there is differentiation because this is the economic situation in Bahrain is very bad. It's not that good one like EU. And at the same time, as you mentioned, the what happened in during the Arab Spring in Bahrain, which always kept away from the world media, and no one wanted to talk about the revolution that happened in Bahrain, and the intervention came from Saudi Arabia by sending the troops to Bahrain to sit down the uprising there. The situation there, it means that the people, as you mentioned, the human rights record, the people who are not happy with the regime, the attempts even till today in order to throw out this regime and the demonstration that is always not covered by the media in general, especially in the Arab world, it's all that indicates that the Bahraini are in a big problem in a way or another, and they want to get some international attention saying that we are, you know, peace lovers when we are okay with Israel, and Israel is very much accepted, and especially to make sure that the Americans are happy by, you know, usually talking to Israel and having this kind of peace treaty with Israel.
Okay.
Now, for the Emirates, it's different issue. Sorry for my long statement, but the Emirates is different. They want to invest, and they are trying to enlarge their scale of, trades, and especially with Israel, also for their own reason and for economic reasons. It's more important than Bahrain.
Well, there's something else that is most likely going on here. The depth of it, Laith Maruf, perhaps you can shed light for us. And that is the fact that the UAE years ago was noted to be a hub for spies. I mean, the CIA had actually set up shop there. And we know that when you talk about the U.S. and intelligence and then the CIA, we have to talk about Shin Bet and Israel. And I'm guessing you obviously can tell us more, that there is a wide cooperation that's happening between Israel and the UAE in particular. We could talk about how they have done that in Yemen, on that island, where they have jointly now have a center there. Is that the goal, or from the Israeli side, to want to get in intelligence-wise with the UAE?
Yes, of course. The UAE has played, a little bit nicer with Iran, allowing much trade to happen with Iran. But this is part of the plan to make the Emirates a hub where they can monitor activities. If Iran will be breaching the sanctions and the blockade on it, which it should, then the Americans provide an out for that to at least monitor most of that so they can see who they want to target or what's the infrastructures that are financially that Iran is using. And now with the banks in the Emirates being a hub for trade, the Israelis coming in will increase this levels of monitoring. The Israelis also are offering weapons to the Emiratis. Doesn't mean that Iran was ever going to attack Emirates. Iran is not an aggressive country. But this is also to give the Emirates an advantage over the Ansarullah government in Sana'a, in Yemen, that is threatening to attack Emirati targets as long as the Emirati occupation and the Israeli occupation of Socotra continues.
I got to ask a quick question here because this goes back a couple of years. If you recall the time when Israel was very keen on not wanting the UAE to be sold these F-35 fighter jets, where it opposed that sale to the United Arab Emirates because it said that it wasn't sure about the superiority that it has and the edge that it has, that it would be threatened. It did go ahead afterwards. I guess that sale was done. Why was Israel so intimidated by that?
That's yeah, funny. Well, obviously the sale went through, but it wasn't delivered.
Really?
So the money has been taken from the Emiratis. I don't think the Emiratis will ever see those planes.
Uh-huh.
And the Israelis objected because they like to keep house slaves in their place. They don't accept an Arab, the collaborator, to think that he's equal to an Israeli.
Sure. All right, Saad Nimr, let me come to you now. This is quite interesting. I want to ask you about this particular character by the name of Ben-Gvir. He's the incoming national security minister, okay? Now, what's interesting about this guy is the fact that there was a meeting, I guess, not a meeting, there was a summit or a get-together in Israel, in Tel Aviv recently, of which he was present there along with the UAE ambassador. And he shook hands with the UAE ambassador. They somewhat embraced each other. But then he went around boasting about how he has made peace with Arab states without making concessions. And that to him, peace without concessions, it seems like it's a favorite line with Israeli, I guess, politicians. Is that accurate? And what does that say about the UAE?
Yeah, this is exactly the case. What do they mean to make peace without concession? What kind of concession could Israel give to the Emiratis or to the Bahrainis or even to the Moroccans or all other Arab countries who had already normalized relationship with Israel? The concession is about, the rights of the Palestinians, the rights of the Palestinian in their own land. So he means that we did this without being able to give anything to the Palestinian back or to help the Palestinians. We have to understand that Ben-Gvir himself, he's a settler, and he's one of the most vicious settlers in the region, and he had so many episodes of attacking Palestinians as a person before he became even member of Knesset and later on member of Knesset, and now he's going to be in the government and he's going to be in one of the most important ministries, which is the Ministry of National Security. They changed even the name to national security, and they give him more even responsibilities.
Sure.
In this ministry to and his idea is about to kick out all the Palestinians. It's an ethnic cleansing mentality for the Palestinians, and he want to kick them out in order to create more and more settlements.
Sure.
Now that for him is to make peace without giving any concessions to the Palestinian, definitely something it's, you know, worthwhile for him to be a canto, to celebrate about.
So extreme is he, Leith Maruf, that even members of the Biden administration have said that they're not going to engage with him. Now, either they're playing, either they're putting this facade, or they're really sincere about it. And, of course, given that if this is so true about him, what does that say about the future of the way Palestinians are going to be dealt with because of his role, the role that he has, his direct control over that?
You know, Ben-Gvir's political party is called Jewish Power, in the, you know, same shade as White Power. And it's very important for all of us to repeat the name of his party as often as possible so people can understand what we're dealing with. And along with the religious Zionist party today, who received the deputy minister of defense position, a woman from one of the hilltop settlements in the West Bank. She's been filmed shooting at Palestinians before. They will be Ben-Gvir and the so the Jewish Power Party and the religious Zionist party together will form a new militia of 200,000 colonists. They will that are already
okay. Got it. I think we lost you, Leith Maruf. I'm sorry, but at the same time, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank Leith Maruf. Sorry about that. Leith Maruf, activist and political commentator. And Saad Nimr, thank you, professor of political science at Birzeit University. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahwei and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the role of knowledge in the development of a man. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome everyone, you're listening to A to Z program from the RB English Radio. I'm your host, Hossein Hinzano. Now, in today's lesson, we are talking about the role of knowledge in the development of a man. One of the main points that drive a man to be developed in life is by him acquiring knowledge. And as we know, knowledge that's acquired, the true knowledge that makes a man become developed in life, the true knowledge that brings progress in a man's life, in this world and in the hereafter, is that knowledge that is the one which brings that particular man closer to his creator, closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, the following might be set forth. Even though pragmatism regards validity based on usefulness in earthly life and cannot be approved as such, a pragmatic inclination towards genuineness of work for life in the hereafter is acceptable. Consequently, performing deeds useful for life in the hereafter has relative validity, but knowledge and science and art are deprived of even this relative validity. We'll talk more about this in a few minutes. Please stay tuned.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano, and we are talking about a very important issue here. We're talking about the role of knowledge in the progress of a man, the role of knowledge in the development of a man. We just say that knowledge serves as a very good basis for a man's development in life, in this world and in the hereafter. And the best knowledge is the one which drives him closer to his creator. It must, however, be borne in mind that man's prosperity is rooted in the heart and not in the body organs and limbs and the means. The heart has the principal role in moving towards qurba with Allah, in moving closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thus, relative validity belongs to the activities of the heart, and external deeds become valid in the light of them and not the vice versa. Now, in the same way, that knowledge or the science could become valid as a prelude to decent deeds. It could play a more important role as a prelude to belief, which is prior to action and its basis. Definitely, what we're trying to say here is that a man will need this knowledge in order to go forward. And not just knowledge, he will need the knowledge that will bring in himself, that will build his heart towards wanting to be close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that way, he will have earned himself a knowledge that will bring him closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thank you so much for following up on this show. Thank you so much for being with us in this episode. Until next episode, inshallah, we're hoping we'll be together again. Fi amanillah, wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The United States House of Representatives has announced an investigation into allegations of a secret deal to boost oil production between the administration of President Joe Biden and Saudi Arabia. Biden is accused of trying to arrange a deal with Riyadh to increase oil production ahead of the U.S. midterm elections last month. Conservative lawmakers say that could represent election manipulation. It's the first official probe announced since the Republicans won control of the House of Representatives. Many other controversial hearings are expected to follow, such as on the handling of the coronavirus, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, corruption allegations involving Biden's son, and others. Just as Democrats forced questionable investigations over the past 2 years, a now divided Congress will likely be preoccupied with partisan issues of often questionable importance to the average person.
In the end of neoliberalism, we're in a kind of age of disorder. And this is kind of the show that is being played out, is that people are just going to be disillusioned from politics entirely. And that's going to open up the potential of polarization, like wider polarization.
Pro-Trump representatives in the House have already introduced articles of impeachment against Biden over the family-related corruption allegations. Many are skeptical that Congress will devote enough time to meeting the widespread economic problems caused by record inflation and Western belligerence towards Russia, China, Iran, and others.
Now, let's still push through the agenda that's necessary to maintain the super rich or super rich and that no relief for the working class. And once again, points to the need for the urgency for the foundation for a new party and also ultimately a new system.
An irony is that Riyadh and the OPEC Plus oil production group ultimately ignored Biden's demands for more oil and instead voted to cut production. And despite the cuts, last month Biden still awarded Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman immunity for all cases involving the infamous murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Biden campaigned on holding bin Salman accountable, and his backtracking drew global condemnation. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
More than 1 year after the Taliban returned to power, a Gallup survey has found that almost all Afghans, or 98%, rate their lives poorly enough to be considered suffering. The survey shows that the situation is getting worse for Afghans, and they have fully lost hope that their future will be any better.
Absolutely, people are suffering, especially from joblessness, poverty, insecurity, and little access to their basic rights. Their life conditions were grim even before the Taliban takeover, but recently people's hardships have become even worse. Still, we are not sure what the future holds for us.
Currently, Afghan girls and women are dealing with many difficulties, especially their struggle to get education or a job to make ends meet. Poverty has not only affected men, but also the well-being of Afghan women and children. Being relatively barred from public places makes us further desperate.
According to the survey, 9 in 10 Afghans say they find it very difficult to make ends meet. 92% of the respondents say they think it is a bad time to find a job, while 86% say they have been unable to buy themselves food.
Making ends meet has become very difficult. We need to skip some meals to survive. The arrival of the cold season is adding to the people's suffering. With no job and relief assistance, you can imagine how disastrous people's lives can become.
I'm the sole breadwinner of my 8-member family. Sometimes I can put food on the table, but sometimes we go to bed hungry. The situation is so difficult that sometimes we can't even buy ourselves some oil. Having heating or other necessities is becoming almost impossible.
The Gallup survey also reveals that the unpopularity of the American leadership has risen to a record 84% among Afghans. Meanwhile, the poll shows more and more Afghans are looking favorably towards Iran, as the neighboring country's popularity is on the rise. Afghanistan is rated as the most suffering and unhappiest country in the world. Many here believe the current situation is a direct result of the U.S. occupation and war in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Planned nationwide strikes were supposed to start on Monday across Iran, based on social media posts that have been calling for business owners to roll down their shutters for 3 days. A quick stroll on the streets of Tehran, however, shows that all the fuss is limited to the virtual world.
Life goes on as normal here in this district. I think social media exaggerates the problems. From what I saw today, no one is paying attention to the calls for a strike.
The country has been gripped by street violence for 10 weeks now, with anti-government protests claiming the lives of civilians and security forces. Now the same protesters have called for a 3-day strike, marking the anniversary of the National Student Day in the country.
Student Day belongs to the Islamic Revolution and is a manifestation of the repression exercised by the former Pahlavi regime against our people. So it can't be used to protest against the Islamic establishment. I'm certain that all of the plots hatched to cause trouble to our country are doomed to failure.
Videos circulating on social media show some shops in Tehran's Grand Bazaar closed, However, people say some shopkeepers have closed their shops in fear of vandalism by protesters.
Everyone is busy with their businesses today. There are some shops which have been closed, but the majority of them fear possible damage by protesters.
The Islamic Republic says what's happening on social media is not a true reflection of what's actually going on the ground. Over the past days, Iranian officials have been calling for a national dialogue to, quote, stop the enemy from fishing in troubled waters. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Russian prisoners of war being executed by Ukrainian soldiers. Multiple videos have been released on Ukrainian Telegram channels. The most recent shows 11 Russian soldiers shot in the head after being detained. While both sides accuse each other of war crimes, Kiev is openly flaunting the crimes committed at the hands of its troops. At a press conference in Lugansk, a Russian soldier, Dmitry, recounts what happened when he was captured on the front line.
They ordered me to lie down, hands behind my back. One of them came up to me and hit my back with the handle of his machine gun. They put a bag on my head and waited for their commanders. In some time, the commander came, took the bag off my head, took me by the throat and started to cut my left hand with a knife. It's still functioning badly. He hit me in the teeth. And afterwards, when they took my machine gun from the vehicle, he asked if it was charged. I answered that it wasn't. He took the cartridge from it, clicked it, pointed at my leg and clicked. Nothing happened because it was really not charged. He said I was lucky.
On the screen, gruesome images. Russian authorities say they have evidence of torture and a lack of provision of basic medical care, leading to unnecessary death.
Now, many of these atrocities are being ignored by media outlets in NATO countries, but Russian journalists, of course, are here, transmitting to a Russian audience, which means large parts of the Russian population are becoming increasingly angry at Ukraine and its NATO backers for atrocities committed against Russian soldiers.
The videos that show Russian prisoners of war being essentially murdered after they've surrendered have been posted by Ukrainian soldiers. These are videos taken by Ukrainian soldiers and then posted on the internet, essentially as a point of pride, in the belief that they are somehow or another frightening or horrifying the Russians, who knows. But I also think there's another sinister dimension to this. I think there's an interest in Ukraine, particularly in Kiev or Kyiv, to ensure that there can be no negotiated settlement between Ukraine and Russia, not so much because of people in Kiev that might be willing to talk, but I think there's growing fear that Washington will ultimately abandon them.
As Russia continues to destroy energy infrastructure and kill Ukrainian soldiers on the front lines in Donbass, and as Ukraine continues to shell civilians in Donetsk and release videos of its war crimes, anger is reaching new heights on both sides, making peace an even more distant prospect. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
The repercussions of the war in Yemen and the difficult economic conditions continue to take a heavy toll on Yemeni patients. Yemen's Ministry of Public Health and Population held a press conference to shed light on the impact of the continued Saudi siege on thalassemia patients. Those suffering from this disease need to get blood transfusions every 3 weeks and must stay on medication for life.
Our main concern is the lack of medicines for thalassemia patients. These medicines, if available, are very expensive, in addition to the lack of necessary medical examinations. We have 20,000 registered patients, while the real numbers are many times higher. These children need special medical care, and we hope that international organizations will stand by them by providing them with what they need.
The Yemeni Health Ministry has recorded nearly 500 deaths due to the lack of only one of the drugs used to treat thalassemia. The ones grappling with the disease seem to be losing hope as time goes by. With their health constantly deteriorating, they are desperately asking for help from international organizations, including the UN.
We suffer a lot from thalassemia. Medicines are not available. We need expensive medicines such as growth injections. We also suffer from a shortage of blood donors, which is what we need continuously.
We greatly need to be provided with important medicines that have not been available since the beginning of the war, such as iron withdrawal treatments. Because our iron level is high due to frequent blood transfusions, which also causes frequent infections.
Saudi Arabia's siege on Yemen and the ensuing shortages of food and medicine is putting more lives at risk every day. The healthcare system is feeling a massive strain, and the international community has yet to take any definitive steps towards ending the crisis here. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
The Italian government has been authorized to send, when it sees fit, military assets, materials and equipment to Ukraine until December 31st next year. The go-ahead has arrived from Italy's lower house, the Chamber of Deputies, which has passed a motion presented by the right-leaning parties backing the government coalition and supported by some opposition groups, including Centre-Left Democratic Party and centrist Italia Viva Azione. Italy has so far classified the arms it has been sending to Ukraine, but some media have suggested the next package will likely include air and missile defense.
9 months after the start of the conflict, sending weapons to Ukraine is no longer the way to go. We must put peace talks on the table and work all together for a UN-backed peace conference promoted by the EU.
Support for Ukraine has been a contentious issue within the ruling coalition, with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni positioning herself as a staunch supporter of Kiev. However, her partners Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi, respectively leaders of the League and Forza Italia parties, have been so far much more ambiguous due to their historical ties with Moscow and President Vladimir Putin. The two have repeatedly stressed the urgency of stepping up efforts to promote peace negotiations.
Giorgia Meloni is firmly and strongly linked or attached to the partnership and the alliance in with the United States and with NATO. So I don't think she will do something to promote compromises or peaceful or diplomatic solution.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has recently said, quote, "The Western alliance intends to keep fighting for Ukraine until it wins back all the territory Russia has seized since 2014. However, there seems to be an open wedge between the parliament and the Italian people. Latest polls show that more than half of Italians advocate for peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, and only a third are okay with a country sending more weapons to Kiev.
Peace talks must be started now. They have to find a solution to end this war. This situation is dangerously taking us toward a brink.
We are being run by governments of weaklings in the pocket of NATO, and the Meloni government is no different. Our constitution clearly says Italy rejects war.
It's not anymore a war between Russia and Ukraine. It's about all of us. We begin to feel exhausted.
The approval of the motion in the lower house on supplying weapons to Ukraine also included a provision which increases military spending to 2% of GDP by 2028, as required by NATO. The motion is currently under discussion at the upper house. The Senate will have the final say on the matter. Max Civili, Rome.
Pakistan has hosted a dialogue platform for the OIC member states to boost cooperation among them in the field of science and technology. Senior officials representing Iran, Kazakhstan, Tunisia, Qatar, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Pakistan attended the meeting, while Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Turkey, Azerbaijan, United Arab Emirates, and Cameroon participated via video conference. The first senior officials meeting of the OIC forum was aimed at strengthening scientific cooperation and to encouraging major technological initiatives.
This forum provides us opportunities of bilateral, multilateral cooperation. So one or two or several countries can work together. With Iran, of course, we have a very strong cultural, historical and scientific collaboration. And of course, Pakistan and Iran can work together.
Iran's Deputy Science Minister, Peyman Salehi, told the meeting that OIC was established to strengthen unity and collaboration among Islamic countries. He offered the participants Iran's cooperation in the field of science and technology.
This collaboration between 15 countries may have a very fruitful outcome in the near future. Therefore, we arranged for the first meeting of ministers that will be held, I think, about 4 to 6 months later.
The Iranian minister further said that despite the sanctions imposed by the West, Iran is self-sufficient in the field of science and technology and has invested big in its infrastructure and commercialization of technology.
In 2021, Iranian scientists published about 78,000 papers, peer-reviewed papers in international journals, and at the moment we are in the rank 15 in the world. We have established about 50 science and technology parks in Iran, more than 240 incubators, and so on.
Participants in the meeting discussed in detail the objectives, terms of reference, and working procedures of the OIC 15 and recommended them for adoption by the ministerial committee, which is scheduled to be held in the near future.
The presence of Iranian officials in the OIC meeting shows that Iran is not dependent on the East or the West, and it's ready to boost its political and scientific cooperation with various countries across the globe. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
South Korea's container and cement truck drivers are out in the cold, on strike with no extension to an agreement they say ensures safe cargo transportation and livable incomes. The union also wants tanker trucks, auto carriers, and delivery vehicles included in their deal. The strike action has widened to Seoul Metro Subway, with other transportation workers also threatening walkouts.
Believing in the government's commitment to the constitution and expansion of the safe freight system, we held off the strike and waited. But the system expires in a month, and the government's promise has not been kept. So we had no choice but to bring out our last card, the strike card.
Slowdown in construction and cargo delivery has already caused hundreds of millions in damages each day, with 5,000 truckers off the job. The slowdowns are rippling through South Korea's export-led economy as the strike enters its second week. President Yoon Suk-yeol this week ordered cement truck drivers back to work, with construction companies reporting losses into the tens of millions of dollars.
The foundation of our industries is in danger of being devastated. Even people's daily lives are being threatened. There is no way to justify the act of taking the lives of people and the national economy hostage to accomplish their own interest.
The Yoon administration has vowed to deal sternly with the illegal strike action. The truckers were on strike just 5 months ago, but that strike only ended with the extension of the safe trucking freight rate system through the end of this year. With the government's back-to-work order, the truckers are threatened with fines and even jail sentences for those refusing to get back behind the wheel. Frank Smith, WeWang, South Korea.
In the limelight.
The West's unilateral sanctions and attacks against different countries around the world have had a boomerang effect on the Western countries themselves. According to reports, supply chain disruptions caused by the war in Ukraine, rising fuel costs, and the impact of heat waves on crop yields have all contributed to increased costs for producing and processing food. Farmers have been unable to boost supply, leading to expectations that costs will remain above the levels before the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Global food companies have paid out nearly £15 billion to shareholders. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The website of Common Dreams noted the world's biggest food companies have paid out nearly £15 billion to shareholders as spiraling prices leave desperate families struggling to afford to eat. Open Democracy revealed Nestle, Unilever, Associated British Foods, Mondelez, and Archer Daniels Mill and Company, ADM, have raked in £20 billion in profits in the space of a year while all raising average food prices. Four of the five multinationals, which between them own thousands of popular brands such as Twinings, King's Mill, and Cheerios, have all signaled consumers should expect further price rises. Only ADM has not. The firm's profits would be enough to fill £9.8 billion funding gap twice over that is currently facing the United Nations World Food Programme, WFP, which aims to provide food for 160 million people facing poverty by the end of the year. The WFP said it costs 44% more for it to buy food than it did in 2020. The bonanza for food corporations comes amid a 40% increase in the number of people in the UK forced to turn to food banks since April, according to Trussell Trust. The charity, which supports food banks nationwide, has warned it can no longer rely on donations to meet rising demand for energy food parcels. Frederic Mousseau, an economist who has worked for international relief agencies, including Oxfam and Action Against Hunger, told Open Democracy, "How can we accept that a handful of corporations record such huge profits while you have billions of people who are already struggling to survive?" Food prices in the UK have increased by an average of 16% in the past year, with the cost of some staples, such as bread and milk, rising by a third. The prices of vegetable oil and pasta have soared by more than 60%, the highest increases among the lowest-cost groceries tracked by the Office of National Statistics. The UK's biggest producer of vegetable oil, Edible Oil Limited, is jointly owned by American grain giant Archer Daniels Milland and Princess, a UK subsidiary of Mitsubishi Corporation. The former has seen its profits rise by 48% this year and paid out the equivalent of £1.5 billion to its shareholders in dividends and share buybacks in the first half of this year alone. The UK's highest-grossing food company, Associated British Foods, ABF, has also paid out £500 million to shareholders. This month, ABF's chief executive, George G. Watson, who will receive £2.2 million in remuneration this year, told investors at the firm's annual results presentation, "Revenues benefiting from prices increases and operating profit was solid. We've had to recover a huge amount of input costs from customers that don't like giving you price rises. We've done that job really well, but it's not finished." Some food multinationals have claimed they have tried to soften the blow to consumers when passing on costs. Nestle chief executive Mark Schinder said the company had made a point of acting responsibility with price increases when announcing its half-year results in July. Nestle reported half-year profits of £4.5 billion, 11% fall from the same period last year. But the firm has paid out £8.5 billion to shareholders in the form of share buybacks this year, while raising prices by up to 7.5% on its products, which include a top-selling baby formula. "These corporations are very adept at rhetoric that doesn't have a lot of substance," Philip Howard, a professor at the Department of Community Sustainability
at Michigan State University told Open Democracy. They talk about balance, but if there is a choice between increasing their